4:06. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Ricker. Coming up later, we'll hear about a big musical event taking place this week in the Fox Valley.
First, a settlement has been reached in one of the longest-running and most contentious Catholic Church bankruptcy cases in the country. The Archdiocese of Milwaukee announced yesterday that it has agreed to pay $21 million in a compensation package for victims of childhood sexual abuse.
While the settlement still needs approval from a federal bankruptcy judge, church officials say they're glad to be turning a page on a dark period in their history and refocusing on their spiritual mission. But some are calling the settlement inadequate and pointing out that Milwaukee's plan would pay out the smallest payments per victim compared to other similar bankruptcy cases.
Here with us now for a closer look at this settlement plan is Chuck Kornbach, WPR's reporter in Milwaukee. Chuck, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you. Good afternoon.
Let's start with where this money is going, the $21 million. What does that entail?
Well, it means roughly $44,000, maybe $48,000 for 330 abuse survivors who have still been part of this bankruptcy case, roughly 200-250 who are not to have substantiated claims will either or kicked out of the case because they had sued earlier, will either get very little money, maybe $2,000 apiece for some and none for others. So it's mainly $21 million cut 330 ways.
And then there's some millions of dollars that are going into legal fees for the church.
Oh, that's right. There's been legal fees accumulating. There's also now going to be a $500,000 therapy fund for abuse survivors. And the money is coming from various sources within the archdiocese's control. What has really ramped up in this settlement versus a proposed one about a year ago was about $11 million from a cemetery trust fund. But there's also money coming from the church's insurance companies that are sort of buying their way out of future obligations, it sounds like.
Now, this story goes back, this process goes back a long time. This is the bankruptcy settlement. There have been lawsuits. We're talking over two decades here. Why has it taken so long to get from there to here?
Well, I think, quite frankly, there was a lot of denial by the church that there were problems going on. There were allegations that the Milwaukee County District Attorney for a long time was not as aggressive as he might have been in pursuing some cases. There were various attempts by the church to use, and successfully, to use the religious freedom argument of saying you really can't get involved in our staffing decisions. That's, you know, invades on our religious freedom. But then about 7 or 8 years ago, there was a big change where the victims started pursuing fraud cases, and that started to make some headway in the court system, and there were about 17 cases proceeding when the church very early in 2011 decided, well, let's go to bankruptcy protection and sort this all out in a more lengthy way.
Now, Milwaukee is not the only archdiocese to have filed for bankruptcy over abuse claims. What made this situation unique? It seems like this has been longer and more contentious than a lot of other places.
Well, the victims group certainly tend to point to Archbishop Jerome Listecki. He is an attorney. He is a very blunt-spoken man at times from Chicago who has been very firm in trying to protect, he says, the archdiocese's assets, which run into the hundreds of millions of dollars, it's believed. But Archbishop Listecki has said that he needs to bury the dead, so to speak, in trying to protect that cemetery trust fund. But there was a ruling a few months ago that opened the door to use of that cemetery trust fund. And when that came together, and now maybe Pope Francis is coming to the U.S., maybe there's some other things going on that the archdiocese said, okay, we'll put this on the table and see if the creditors committee accepts, and it looks like they have.
Talking to WPR reporter Chuck Kornbach about this new settlement announced in the bankruptcy case of the Milwaukee Catholic Archdiocese. Let's get to some of the reaction to this. Chuck, first of all, from victims groups, what have they had to say about this settlement?
Well, they are by and large concerned and upset. And I did talk with one person and in one of our stories today, Monica Barrett, who had been already dismissed against her will from the case. And in talking with me yesterday, she was quite concerned, very low, very subdued, as were Peter Eisley, the Midwest head of SNAP, and others. They were all very concerned that it had come down to this. Now, it's, as the saying goes, it's not nothing. It's $21 million that will be shared, but the fact that it's far less than some of the other archdiocese bankruptcies is not. They were seeking more. The victims were seeking more information about the clerics and what the church knew and when they knew it and so on. So they're sort of, for the victims groups are saying, we, you know, is this all there is? But there is something, but it appears if the bankruptcy judge approves this, that's what it will be, although there may be some individual claims cases that go forward.
Now, the director of the national group, Survivors Network of Those Abused by Priests, I understand his quote was that this is the, quote, largest mass betrayal of child sex abuse victims we've ever seen by one diocese. Are you hearing that kind of heated rhetoric here in Wisconsin?
Well, and David Clossy also said that it was cramming a self-serving plan down the throats of struggling abuse victims. So, yeah, the rhetoric was pretty heated. I mean, in Wisconsin, it's a bit more muted. There is certainly concern. There's dismay and But right now, there's also this sense, well, the creditors committee, which included some abuse survivors, did the best they could. And that's what some victims are saying. But others are more upset. They just don't know what they can do to change the proposed settlement at this point.
And we touched on a little in the intro. Can you tell us a little bit more about the church's explanation of this, so what they're saying moving forward?
Well, you know, using phrases like new road, new day, et cetera, they are acknowledging that there was hurt. Jerry Topchefsky, chief of staff of the Archdiocese, said, you know, no amount of money can restore what was taken from these abuse victims or survivors long ago as children being molested by priests and other religious officials. But they are saying, listen, we now have this therapy fund. We've helped victims along the way. We report cases to the district attorney's office. We are getting our house in order. We're ready to move on. Please join with us. We'll see in the next few months.
That's a key point. This just because this announcement has been made doesn't mean it's a done deal. What would have to happen to have this be done and this part of the bankruptcy closed?
Well, the formal plan, I think, is filed with federal judge Susan Kelly, bankruptcy judge Kelly, at the end of August, end of this month. And then she's holding a hearing in November where presumably then or shortly thereafter she'll make a ruling. I've sat in Judge Kelly's courtroom. She's sort of thrown up her hands at sometimes at some of these attorneys' arguments back and forth. And the perception is that she's ready to be through with this case unless, you know, new things surface in the next few months.
And is there any thought that this would move to higher courts? I know some people mentioned a U.S. Supreme Court angle, an appeal somewhere along the line.
Well, I haven't heard that. That was, as part of that came up during this discussion of the cemetery trust fund, that the Archdiocese stressed that it's not going to take that cemetery trust for ruling and not going to ask the Supreme Court to review or overturn that. But whether some of these individual victims' cases might go on after the bankruptcy part is done is a possibility.
Chuck, thanks a lot for joining us, as always.
Thank you.
That's WPR reporter Chuck Kornbach joining us to talk about the Milwaukee Archdiocese $21 million settlement with victims of sexual abuse. A mile-long stretch of Appleton's downtown will turn into an oasis of music with over 60 venues opening their doors to host a variety of concerts and musical performances.
The Mile of Music Festival, now in its third year, is bringing over 200 artists to the Fox Valley for 4 days of original music in places like bars, coffee shops, and even museums. Some have called it Wisconsin's version of South by Southwest.
Here with us now to tell us more about the festival is Dave Willems. He's president of Willems Marketing and Events, and he's the co-founder of Mile of Music. Dave, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Hey, thanks for having me. It's great. And I like the Oasis of Music. You don't mind if I use that, do you?
You can steal that. Sure. You have my permission.
Yeah.
Well, third year now for the Mile of Music, Mile 3, I understand you're calling it. Talk to us about how you got started on this.
Sure, yeah. It's hard to believe that. And we really did the first one in about 3 months or 4 months. So it's been just over 2 years since we kind of launched the concept, and this will be our third festival. It's going to be always kind of that first full weekend in August, very likely without too much variation. But we're kind of trying to pin ourselves maybe a weekend after Lollapalooza down in Chicago, so we can really kind of appeal to the music fans throughout the upper Midwest with a festival right after that one. Ours is strictly original music, and it really came about through some conversation I had with Corey Chisel, who's a national singer-songwriter based out of Nashville now, grew up here in Appleton, and really wanted to do something cool for his hometown because they've always supported him in a great way. Originally, he got his launch in music because he was scholarshiped to the local boy choir, Appleton Boy Choir, and that was an awesome story, and he always wanted to give back, and so this is a chance for us to do that, and we actually have, the proceeds. When we have proceeds, we're still building toward that, but when we have them, they're going to go to a local music education fund that we've established.
And one of the things that's unique about this festival's music lineup, there's no cover bands and no covers of songs either. Why did you go that way?
We went that way because from an original music perspective, we really wanted a festival that was more handcrafted, authentic, had kind of some of those artisan themes, and that to us said original music. And the other part of that is there's so many festivals out there that are amazing festivals that have either a combination of original and cover, or they're pretty much strictly cover bands, or they're festivals that feature bands that have been out there for 30, 40 years and do a great job. We didn't think there were a lot of them that were looking at really promoting the troubadours, promoting the singer-songwriters, at least not in the upper Midwest, and so we wanted to try to find a niche, and quite frankly, the other reason was we wanted to look for artists that wanted to come to Appleton, that would have sought out Appleton as a destination, and I think from that standpoint, we were lucky that we kind of hit that one head on, because the artists just love coming here. They love the fact that they're pretty much required to play their own music, and they all sign a pledge that they'll play their own music, and that's become a really cool feature of the festival.
So if they start playing a cover, they get the hook, huh?
Right, we just tackle them. No, it's one of those things where they're all 50-minute sets, so they're not even an hour, and it's very similar to other multi-venue festivals where they maybe range in sets from 30 to 50 to an hour, hour and 10 minutes long. We have that 50-minute spot, so the artists we bring in all have typically produced a CD or an album, maybe two or three, in some cases like Charlie Parr from Duluth, 12 or 13, so it's they all have enough material to play that 50 minutes and to really play their stuff that they know gets the crowd excited and gets the crowd interested. One of the hallmarks we've had so far that I feel very proud about is we pay all the artists something who come here, and we also give them a hotel room, some lodging, and we give them some nice food and drink while they're here as part of the artist lounge. But above all, they really sell a lot of their merchandise when they're here. And as you know, for artists, that's really important.
You've got around 800, I think, live performances scheduled over the next few days. So this is a horrible question to ask you. What artists and bands are you personally really excited to catch their set?
Sure, I thought you were going to say, what are you doing an interview? No, I'm just kidding. It's about 770 that we ended up settling in at, so we didn't quite hit the 800 mark. We feel terrible. We put that on the poster. No, I'm just kidding. But it has been a busy time, obviously, and from an artist perspective, we get asked that question a lot, and I just got asked that question last night by someone, actually, and there are several. We have bands coming from 21 or 22 states, I believe. There's some great bands right here from Wisconsin, so I would pepper mine by saying somebody like a Delta Routine from Milwaukee. I love that band. Pretty much a straight-ahead rock band. I'm going to definitely try to catch them. But when you look outside the state, there's a duo called Brother O' Brother from Ohio that just really sounds like it's about five or six people in the band. They're really good. And we have a solo act that plays about four different instruments. He plays three different drums. He's called the Suitcase Junk, and his name is Matt Lorenz. He's from Boston. And he's actually playing our debut show tonight, which is the first song show, which is a sampling of several artists. And he's playing that at the PAC tonight, and then the festival starts tomorrow. But the Suitcase Junket will definitely be someone I'll have on my list.
Now, there was an opinion piece in the Appleton Post-Crescent that ran this weekend about the Mile of Music, and there's a quote from it I want to read here. It was, "No matter whether you're actually going to Mile of Music, no matter what you think of it, there's one thing that can't be denied. The festival has absolutely transformed this town." So with that in mind, what kind of change have you seen in Appleton because of Mile of Music, and what do you see as the future possibilities?
Well, that's a great question. We we felt going into it, and you have these ideas, and this, even if it's a big idea or even sometimes the small ideas, you're looking for some sort of result. And one of our thoughts was if we could have a great event that served the creative economy, that pushed both the creative side and the economic side, that would be great. But the other piece of it was if we could just kind of be that activity that maybe served as a catalyst, that kind of popped open the can a little bit and let some other great ideas come out. We have some pretty impressive artists here in the Appleton Fox Cities area, largely because of Lawrence University, largely because of a number of folks who settled here who love the community for an awful lot of reasons. And really, this was a chance to start to give them a little bit of voice and give them a little bit of face, and that's what's happened. We've had some really cool spin-off-type art programs that are starting here. Some of the venues are now starting to invest in equipment and starting to do their own live music, live original music. And quite frankly, as we go along here, perfectly fine if it's live original or live cover music. It's just going to be an opportunity for more musicians to have a chance to make their way to Appleton, or even just to settle in here to Appleton to make this their home.
Another focus, I understand, of Mile of Music is to get people not just listening to music, but playing music, too. Can you tell us about that side of the effort?
Yeah, that's been a cool thing. That's really important to Corey. He, he started here. It wasn't always easy to launch your career from Appleton. He's a pretty rare story to be able to have done that and to be able to pack houses here and then to take that and parlay that into a record deal. He wants to make that an easier process for some of the talent we have here, and not just Appleton in the Fox Cities, but Northeast Wisconsin. We're doing some things in Green Bay. We're doing some things down in Oshkosh. The goal is to work with our youth to do some things. There's a facility that he's developing called The Refuge, which is an old monastery, friar's house, that we're going to be using for developing, teens and other singer-songwriters who want to come out there, and they're going to spend like a month out there doing some work with existing artists, all sponsored and funded by local business people who want to support that. We've already had two youth out there. One of our sponsors last year did a Tundraland Home Improvements, did a really cool event with a singing in the shower activity, and from that they ended up sponsoring youth who has been spending the year playing guitar and learning guitar, and he's going to be at one of our debut shows playing along with Corey, actually. So it's going to be a cool thing that way.
Well, Dave, thanks so much. Sounds like a lot of fun.
Thank you very much.
That was Dave Willems, co-founder of Mile of Music, which kicks off tomorrow in Appleton. And we're going to go out now to the news with some music from one of the bands that's going to be playing Mile of Music. This is Oshkosh's The Traveling Suitcase from their recent appearance on our Friday music series, Setlist.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up, Governor Walker and Republican lawmakers say they want to change Wisconsin's election board by 2016. We'll learn more with a state capitol reporter coming up.
First, the Wisconsin State Fair kicks off tomorrow for an 11-day celebration of all things Wisconsin. The fair is celebrating its 164th year. It'll have all the classic favorites like music, beer, and of course, the cream puffs.
We wanted to learn more about the history of the State Fair and see how past events compare with the 2015 edition. We're joined now by Kathleen O'Leary, Marketing Director for the Wisconsin State Fair. Kathleen, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you so much.
Well, what can you tell us about what that very first State Fair was like?
You know what? The very first State Fair in 1851 was held in Janesville. And the interesting part about this was that it was sponsored by the State Agricultural Society. And the ultimate goal of the society was that if they could hold a gathering and bring everyone to one location and citizens could meet, they could start this organization with a big drive to obtain members at $1 per year or a $10 membership fee. And ultimately, it really was a grand success. They reported between 8,000 to 12,000 fairgoers on the grounds that during that window of time. It was only a two-day event. It was held October 1st through and 2nd, first and 2nd, so it was only 2 days. But it really was a great success. They feel that that was the beginning of what ultimately is now a 164-year tradition, which is the tradition of the Wisconsin State Fair.
Well, so what year was this exactly?
1851.
1851. So if I was walking around in 1851 at that very first state fair in Janesville, what kind of things would I have seen?
You know what? It was a lot of displays of agriculture in the sense of more displays on produce. That was the very big, very popular, and the farmers really enjoyed earning their bragging rights about that. So that's what you saw mostly. The fair was credited with being the largest reported gathering at any Wisconsin event held up to that date. And it was described, when described, it said, the fair as an orderly affair without a single intoxicated man in the crowd. And that was noted by Milwaukee Sentinel at the point. No disorderly conduct, no gambling appearance, no liquor bottle, no profanity, nothing in short to offend the eye or mar the general enjoyment.
Well, some of those things may have changed a little bit. I know there's liquor at the state fair now, but a lot of other things have changed as well. Now, the fair moved around a lot, it sounds like, during those early years. You mentioned Janesville. What other cities hosted the fair?
It was transient for 41 years. It was held in Watertown, Fond du Lac, Madison, and multiple locations in Milwaukee. And it wasn't until 1892, which is 123 years ago, in 1892 the fair came to West Allis, which is where the home has been now for the last 123 years.
What made West Allis the winner?
The location, really. The centrally located area, the amount of acreage. And at that time, there was boarding, because that's what happened to a lot of these locations. When the exhibitors wanted to come in, they had nowhere to stay because they were in these smaller towns. So that's why Milwaukee tended to be where it was, Milwaukee and Madison. But the fairgrounds here in West Allis, which border Milwaukee and West Allis, proved to be the one that really seemed to be able to accommodate all of the needs.
Now, interestingly, in the annals of state fair history, it sounds like the fair has only been canceled 5 times since 1851. Do you remember some of the reasons why the state fair would actually be canceled?
I can certainly tell the listeners. In 1861, the fair was set to be held in Madison, and it was canceled due to the Civil War, as was the 1862 and 1863 years. So there was that 3 consecutive years of cancellation due to the Civil War. The next cancellation was in 1893 when the World's Columbian Exposition was held in Chicago. And basically the fair officials at that time anticipated a loss of attendance just because of the competition, so felt that it was, you know, a good reason to cancel the fair for the 4th time. And the 5th and final cancellation happened in 1945 during World War II, and that was really truly at the request of the U.S. Office of War and Transportation.
Now, these days, the big things that might, I guess the big thing I should say, that would interfere with the state fair, it seems to be the weather. Have there been remarkable meteorological events in recent years or in history that have kind of shut down the fair like that?
You know what? We've had fires. We've had one very large fire. We've had a tornado. They've shut them down for periods of time, but they weren't necessarily canceled due to them. And certainly the fair now being, I mean, whether it was the 2 days in 1851 and moved into a multiple day, and now for the last, you know, many, many years being an 11-day fair, we always have some type of weather element. We are in the beautiful state of Wisconsin, and we are a weather-dependent event. Any event is certainly weather-dependent. So it has fluctuated our attendance, certainly in good days, good years, bad years. Heat is the absolute nemesis of the Wisconsin State Fair in particular. Everyone thinks it's rain, but ultimately it's heat. Heat will keep the attendance very, very low.
And this year looks to be mild. Is that what you're expecting?
If the forecasters and the meteorologists can be accurate, I'm really excited about what the attendance will be and what the experience for the fairgoers, because this tempered 74, 75, 76 degrees is exactly what we, you know, all hope for. And we hope for it as officials. Don't get me wrong. We work tirelessly to make this a great, you know, 11 days and a great Wisconsin State Fair. But ultimately, it's what we want for the fairgoers, because you can bring the kids. If you're more mature, if you're older, the weather is nicer for you to be able to be comfortable. If you're a family with young children, it certainly helps with, you know, having the kids not being hot, for just the pure enjoyment of being in the barns and seeing the animals, eating and drinking. Your stay is a much better stay, an experience overall, but you have a tendency to stay longer, which certainly as fair officials we like.
We're talking with Kathleen O'Leary right now, marketing director for the Wisconsin State Fair. We're getting a history of the State Fair over the years. And Kathleen, this year's State Fair historical exhibit focuses on the 1948 State Fair centennial celebration. What kinds of things is this exhibit going to have if we go to see it?
You know what? In 1948, it was the longest. The entire State Fair Park was renovated and given a facelift to provide basically a modern appearance. And that year, that fair was 23 days long, and it was truly a celebration of the state centennial, of it being, you know, that 100 years. And we created a new press and radio facility, which is virtually still here, which is a radio station here in Milwaukee. We had live broadcasts. The exhibits displayed progress made by the state during its first 100 years and celebrated in various ways. The admission was 50 cents, and the attendance for that 23 days between August 7th through the 29th was 1,786,818 people.
Wow. Were there cream puffs back then?
There were cream puffs back then. Cream puffs actually started in 1924.
Oh, wow, that's quite a history.
Yes, 91 years ago. 91 years ago, which there's a great story behind that. And what I love about it so much, because certainly it is our signature food item, I'm very close to the Wisconsin Bakers Association. I'm very proud of the fact that we, you know, last year we sold over 400,000 cream puffs. And over the course of, you know, the last several years, we've done everything in our name to try and figure out how to maximize not only productivity, but maximize the way in which we can get them into the fairgoers' hands. So we've, in the original Cream Puff Pavilion, which was built in 1924, 91 years ago, it is still the bakery, and it is still where all of the cream puffs are made. And what's really nice about it is that the vision back then, you know, now you see a lot of interactive windows and, you know, restaurants where you can see people cooking and doing all of that. But 91 years ago, they did this. And as you're waiting in the queue line to get your cream puffs, for the listeners that have not experienced this, you can actually watch the whole process from the puffs coming out of the oven to when the cream goes on them, how they're brought through the window. So that's fabulous. But that's the mainstay. Then we have created a walk-up window, so when the dairy bakery closes, we have the ability to still serve the cream puffs. We have two remote locations where we sell six packs and three packs of cream puffs by two very busy gates. We do have the cream puffs in three packs, which is our triple play and our six packs. And then the beautiful thing is that you can actually pre-order cream puffs and pick them up between 6 a.m. and 8 a.m. prior to us opening the gates during the 11 days of the fair, to take to work, to playground, to church, whatever it may be. So we really try and do everything we possibly can to make sure that everybody that's waited 365 days can get their cream puffs over the course of the 11 days.
And aside from the cream puffs, another underpinning of the fair since the beginning, as you pointed out, since this is an agricultural thing, has been that agriculture element, the livestock. What are some of the exhibits in history and this year that have stood out?
You know what? Again, we really try to educate. We actually call it agucate at the Wisconsin State Fair. There's no question about that. Entertain and educate. We work with the Milk Marketing Board and the Dairy Marketing Board, Dairy Committee. We have a House of Moo, which is a beautiful area within the cattle barn where it really, again, is an engaging exhibit, and it kind of explains how the whole process of not only milking and the cows works, but it's done in a very fun way, which takes us to the Discovery Barnyard. We have this one wonderful exhibit right in the heart of Ag Village that you come in and it's all interactive. There are some live animals in there where maybe there's a horse with her colt or a cow with her calf, and they're born, but it explains the differences either between the two. It explains, you know, what the process was like. It explains how many teeth does a horse have. Lots of trivia, lots of ways in which, you know, you will retain that. We like the idea of this information to be resonated. We work closely with the Department of Agriculture and our farm-to-family building, and that is, you know, wonderful, because the hamburger at McDonald's, the hamburger at your favorite restaurant just didn't get there. How did that get there? How did that bacon from your bacon, lettuce, and tomato sandwich actually really happen? And again, it's done in a very educational way that's interactive and useful knowledge.
And Kathleen, just briefly, is there anything new this year? Any special attractions that would-be visitors should know about?
You know what? We have, I mean, certainly being 164 years old, we're steeped in tradition and all of the traditions of the cream puffs, the 25-cent milk, certainly all of our pavilions, the Wisconsin Products Pavilion. I can't say enough to the listeners. For those that have been, they know exactly where I'm going to take them. For those that haven't been, you must attend the Wisconsin Products Pavilion or go through that. That is where we are. We all should be so proud of our commodity groups. That's where the cranberry growers, the apple growers, the potato growers, the poultry producers are all there, and they are serving up their signature items.
Kathleen, thanks a lot for joining us.
Oh, thank you, and I hope everyone can get out here. It is the 11 greatest days of summer. We will open our gates every day at 8 o'clock, August 6th through the 16th, and come early and come often and enjoy a celebration of everything we should be so proud of in Wisconsin.
That was Kathleen O'Leary, Marketing Director for the Wisconsin State Fair, helping us look back at the fair through the years.
And we want to hear from you now at 800-642-1234. What are some of your favorite memories or experiences at the State Fair? If you're planning on going this year, what are you really looking forward to? What would you like to see at the fair? What's been in something maybe in the past that isn't there anymore? Call in now, 800-642-1234. 1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also share your thoughts, your memories over at the Central Time Facebook page.
You can join the conversation right now at 800-642-1234. What are your favorite memories or experiences from the Wisconsin State Fair? If you're going to go to the fair this year, what are you looking forward to? And what are you planning to see and do and maybe eat? You can call us at 800-642-1234, or you can leave us a comment over on the Central Time Facebook page.
We will go right to our callers. We've got Sue on the line in Madison. Sue, hi.
Hi. A wonderful show. One of my, I am over 70, and I remember as a kid, my parents taking us to the fair, and as fun as the fair was, it was always during a meteor shower. So one of my favorite memories is returning from Milwaukee after the fair and looking out the window for shooting stars.
Wow. Did you ever pull over in maybe a dark field somewhere and look up and watch on the way home?
You know, 60 years ago, it wasn't so light.
Good point. Sue, that's a great memory. Thank you so much for calling in to share that.
Thank you for that. And we're going to go next to Philip in Eau Claire. Hi, Philip.
Hi. I have three or four memories that kind of run together. We went to the State Fair in 1976, and I believe that's where we learned that, maybe 77, that's where we learned that Elvis Presley died.
Oh. Hmm.
And then I remember the cream puffs. And I remember the rabbits, and I was doing a radio show on community WORT in Madison at that point, and I did some poetry about all that, which people seemed to really like a lot. I don't remember the poetry, but it was a wonderful memory, and I just love sharing it.
So your poem tied together Elvis Presley's death, rabbits, and cream puffs.
Yeah, sort of. It was kind of a stream of consciousness.
I guess so.
Technique, and I sort of adopted the persona of Percy Dove Tonsil. You remember, kind of an effete poet, which is kind of funny if you know me, because I'm a really big ex-wrestler.
Not familiar, but that's so interesting. A lot of encapsulated in that single day at the State Fair. Well, thank you so much, Philip, for sharing your memory.
We are taking your calls about the Wisconsin State Fair kicking off this week. What's your favorite memory? What are you looking forward to if you're planning to go this year? 800-642-1234. Mention the rabbits. I mean, I was saying earlier, I did not know there were that many kinds of rabbits until
of
I
rabbits.
Went to the state fair. Amazing.
Yeah,
yeah, just a whole lot of rabbit variety. I love it. We'll go back to our callers now at 800-642-1234. Ashley joins us next in Cornell. Ashley, hi.
Hi. My favorite memory was the first time that I took my children to the fair. They were 6 and 4 at the time. And to hear that innocent giggle, that cackle that kids do, and the smiles on their face, and the, you know, the sugar-coated cotton candy strung from ear to ear is just something that I know that I could not have gotten that experience anywhere else but the fair. And I know it's a memory that will last forever that no one will ever take from me.
That's a wonderful picture, Ashley. Apart from the cotton candy, what really brought a smile to their faces there at the state fair?
Oh, you know, I don't know if it was just the rides, you know, the spinny rides, or if it was the fact that I could run this way, he can run that way, and Mom can only get one of us.
Uh-oh. Ashley, that's great. Thank you so much for sharing that.
Let's go next to Shelley. Shelley's joining us in Madison. Hi, Shelley.
Hi. Oh, thank you for having this program. I loved it. And I loved hearing all about the history of the fair.
Yeah.
I'm originally from South Dakota, and most people, I think, would think I was born and raised at the fair. I love the fair. I love to eat the cream puffs. I love the animals, and I love going to, like, the place where the flowers and the plants and where the designers are. There's no part of it I don't like.
Wow, I can hear that enthusiasm.
Yeah.
Right. You're loving it all. You said you were raised at the state fair, so this has been a big part of your life.
No, I wasn't. I said people would think I was.
People would think
I'm not
you
even
were.
Originally from South. I'm not originally from Wisconsin. And regardless, I love it, and I'm just floored when I run into people who have lived their entire lives here, and they haven't gone to the state fair. And I tell them what they have missed.
All right. Well, I think you're selling our technical director Michelle on this, who has never been to the state fair. We'll see if we can turn her around. Shelley, thanks a lot for sharing your favorites.
You can join in with your state fair memories, your favorite state fair experiences, or what you're looking forward to at 800-642-1234. I heard from some of our colleagues around the state, John Munson. Now, he's up there in Superior. You hear him on the Ideas Network sometimes. He says, you know, state fair is great. He wishes it was in a more central location in the state. It's a long haul, he says. Those in the northern half of the state, other than 4-H members who are exhibiting, it's tough to get through to, tough to make that long trip. A lot of them go to the Minnesota State Fair. And we heard from Scott Myers in Milwaukee, very local there. A ping pong tournament, he says, each year at the Oriental Pavilion, winner gets a cash prize. There's a 16 and under bracket, and he made it in when he was a young teenager. Played in the finals against the brother of a friend of his, and ended up losing to him. But maybe next time, Scott, in the adult category, I guess now.
Well, let's go back to our callers now. We've got Brenda joining us from La Crosse. Hi, Brenda.
Hi.
What is your favorite thing about the fair?
Well, I have two memories about the fair. The first time I ever went was when I was in high school. I went as part of the state FHA chorus. And actually, from my high school, was also the accompanist for that year. So that was quite an experience for us, coming from a little town with, at that time, I think the population where I lived was about 600. Mm. Now it's over 900, but it's still a small town where I live. And then the second one was I went to school at Milwaukee County General Hospital, and the nursing students, we used to walk from County General out at 8900 West Wisconsin Avenue to the State Fair. And you paid to get in, but then the show was free, and I remember seeing Diana Ross and the Supremes.
Mm. Oh, how cool. Well, that's a great memory. You could walk there. That's not something a lot of people can do.
Right, right.
Very cool. Well, thanks, Brenda.
And we'll go next to Brian in Endeavor. Brian, hi.
Good afternoon. Hey, I remember back in 1978 was my last year of being able to show in 4-H at the state fair, and I had took a cow and a heifer the first week of the fair, and turned around, brought them all the way back to Endeavor, loaded up my sheep, and went back for the second week of the fair. And it was the last of the last that I was ever able to show in junior show at the fair, and it'd be something I'll never forget.
And Brian, did you take home any ribbons?
Oh, you always take home ribbons, but the Bluewoods are... hard to come by.
All right. That's a great experience. Brian, thank you so much for sharing that. Yeah, seeing especially the youth exhibiting the livestock and all the projects from 4-H, not just the livestock, they're everything up to computer programming now. It seems like a great experience for kids around the state.
And my memory is going to see some beautiful horses. I don't even know if this is true or not, but I feel like I saw the horse who played the Black Stallion in the movies at the State Fair, and then we went to see Kenny Rogers, who was playing, and we only saw a little bit before a tornado warning sent everybody running home. But, you know, that and the cream puffs, so many fun things at the fair.
Yeah, cream puffs. I love seeing the livestock shows. One of our kids is apparently allergic to roosters, we've discovered. Sneezing breaks out only in the chickens.
Roosters?
Chickens, okay. Roosters, no. I don't know why. So we have to steer clear of the rooster zone at county fairs, at state fairs. Otherwise, fun had by all.
I've never heard of that.
Me neither. But I witnessed it.
Well, thanks so much for all your calls about the state fair. And you can keep that conversation going over on the Central Time Facebook page.